I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, migrants, borders, and the quest for a better life. No nation in history is founded on greater diversity. But the reality is, America's immigrant history has never been easy.
There is like a bit of a Disneylandification around the Ellis Island era of like, look, see, they got in line and they got checked for lice and they got their exams and then they were set forth on the world. And thanks to them, we get to be who we are. And I think that is a really, really false narrative of what happened.
And later, one border worker's dilemma and the power of being seen.
You're doing all kinds of really, really mundane things. You are getting people coffee. You are sitting and talking to them. You're watching their kids while they like repack their bags for the 10th time. You're lending people your phone so they can text people back home or that are waiting for them on the other side of the border.
The complexities of migration from borders and identity to our sense of belonging. That's coming up on Life Examined. This week and next, we're discussing questions of migration. What does it mean to pick up and start anew? What are the forces behind this impulse? Next week, we'll discuss how climate might result in massive new migratory patterns. But this week, we'll start with what's happening now and the southern border. A brief glance at America's migrant history remains to this day an extraordinary celebration of how diverse the U.S. population is. From the Native Americans who were here long before the earliest settlers arrived, most Americans alive today can trace back their roots far away from our shores. Yet despite stories of success and opportunity, the history of immigration is complex. Migrants are rarely welcomed with open arms and often ostracized and distrusted. Much of the anti-immigrant rhetoric we hear today is the same as it was centuries ago. The narratives may shift with each era, but the experience is strikingly similar. Today, America's southern border isn't the Ellis Island of the 1800s, but for immigrants navigating the border, the anguish, fear, and fatigue is the same. And the drivers of migration, war, poverty, economic hardship, now include the impacts from climate change. The movement of people shows no sign of easing. According to a recent poll, around 900 million people globally wish to migrate. Lauren Markham has spent 15 years working at the intersection of education and immigration. As a journalist, she's reported from the borders of Greece, Mexico, and Texas to gang-controlled regions of El Salvador. Her latest book is titled A Map of Future Ruins, On Borders and Belonging. Lauren Markham, welcome to Life Examined.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
You know, the theme of immigration, I find, is so unbelievably complex in how we even begin to talk about it, right? There's emotional ties, there's political ideas, there's the administrative stuff happening around us. There's the fact that we, whoever is listening, has at one point immigrated somewhere in their family's lineage, right? And I wonder for you and all the years that you've spent thinking and writing about this, like how do you find a way to begin talking about such a big topic that we think about all the time, but sometimes don't know what words to use when we begin the conversation?
That's such a lovely question. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that part of the problem in talking about migration is that we often talk about it as a border issue, as in something that is an issue, as in a problem, and something that occurs at or near or related to a border. And the interesting thing is that actually borders are, first of all, figures of the human imagination, and actually pretty new. Like, the nation state border is pretty new in the scope of human history. And so often, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm a storyteller, I'm a writer. What I try to do is understand and look at immigration, yes, through a wider lens, as you say, and to do it through particular stories. So my first book was about unaccompanied minor twin teenagers who came from El Salvador, you know, by themselves when they were 17 into the United States. But I found, after telling many, many stories again and again, and sort of telling a lot of individual stories, that as much as those stories unlocked greater truths and deep textures about the vastness of what we think of as immigration as a political issue, I actually found over time that I felt like I was sort of doing the same thing again and again and telling the same sort of story. Even though the particulars were so different, I was really, really interested in thinking about migration really like as a human question over many, many years. So this book, A Map of Future Ruins, that I just published, is thinking about migration with that much wider lens and thinking less about an individual story and more about the overlapping and interlocking nature of migration stories throughout time and space.
Mm, can you go a little further into that? I think that's really interesting to think about what this means outside of the individual stories. I mean, I'm also fascinated about how those narratives began to stitch together into something much greater, but I'll let you kind of keep going there.
That's a really great question. I think that what I started to see was a real disparity and distance between the way we narrate and understand stories of immigration today, where we think of people crossing the border, often from our south of our border or the global south, crossing into the United States, and the way we narrate stories of migrations past. So my great-grandmother's migration from Greece, my great-grandparents' migration from Greece in like the Ellis Island era. We have a really, really different way of telling those stories. The current story, the story of what's happening today, is one of crisis and flooding and overburdened systems and too many people and desperate hordes. And the way we tell the Ellis Island era story, for instance, is these people coming for a better life and doing the sort of bootstraps thing creating the generations that are now often in positions of power and certainly of positional privilege. And so I really wanted to look at the distance between those. And so ultimately ended up writing a book in which I'm looking into my family's Ellis Island era story. I'm looking at the kind of border politics around the world today, and I'm looking at in particular migration in Greece and in Europe today as a way to kind of understand what was happening in the US a little bit more. That was another dimension of this project for me, that I felt like I kept talking about the US border in such a way that I had nothing else to say, and I felt as though I was stuck in some way, that I was beating the same drum, but that I was also a bit stuck, that there must be another way to think about or look at this. And it really helped to start reporting from a different, incredibly different, but also with many, many parallels context, which is the European immigration reality today.
So fascinating, because I think that anybody or some people who are listening would identify with that. Like, for example, in my last name is Bastian, so I have this mythology passed down to me of the Bastian brothers arriving from Germany to the U.S. and getting on a covered wagon and heading to South Dakota. And it's like, right, it's this story that's passed down from generation, and we think of it as mythic. We think of it as heroic. We think of it as, so much of who we are and how we identify as Americans or German Americans. I mean, honestly, barely German Americans at this point. We don't even say that. Right. But it strikes me that you're describing these different tiers of immigration in terms of what we think is acceptable or not acceptable, or where do we place our emotions? Because certainly the stories of, let's say, an El Salvadoran at the border or these, German brothers showing up are so different. So I can't help but think, but why is this racial? Is it a different time in the world? How do we begin to understand it?
Those were all the same questions that that animated me and that continue to animate me, right? Like, when does a story move from sort of factual journalistic tale into kind of family or cultural myth, right? When does that happen? When do the Bastian brothers become, poor, mistreated wretches crossing a border to, right, to this the patriarchs, the ancestral patriarchs of this family that offered this family, yours, inclusion, and the same with my great grandparents from Greece. I had that question. And then the other question is, how much do we sanitize what happened to those people coming through Ellis Island? I really take great pains to not make any false equivalencies between my great grandparents coming from Greece in 1914 and the way they were treated with what is the absolutely horrific abuses happening at our border and at borders around the world today. And at the same time, there is like a bit of a Disneylandification around the Ellis Island era of like, look, see, they got in line and they got checked for lice and they got their exams and then they were set forth on the world. And thanks to them, we get to be who we are. And I think that is a really, really false narrative of what happened.
So then tell me, as you kind of further try to think through these subjects, like how is it that we've now ended up with one narrative, which is the southern border, and one narrative that is kind of the European story. Where's our landing point here? How do we make sense of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's what I was looking at. And in fact, some of the rhetoric that was used against Greek Americans or Southern Europeans, you know, in the early 1900s, like hordes of scum, they're, you know, morally inferior, the way they were sort of racializing their facial descriptions and using that as an indicator that they were morally inferior and bringing all sorts of moral and economic and vice to the United States. Honestly, that rhetoric really sounds very similar today with some substitutions and some maybe like updating of language, you know, in more modern parlance. So I actually think that what we're seeing today is partially a continuum of what's always been true, which is that a nation state sort of creates these borders that then requires outsiders in order to define the insiders. And particularly when the narrative is determined by politicians who are trying to convince the insiders that they need protectors, right? And that's how strongmen come to power. That is happening all over the planet. That's happening in Greece. That's happening in the United States. That's happening in Hungary. That's happened in Brazil, right? That's happened all throughout the world in all sorts of political contexts, that these strongmen are saying, there are people coming here and you need me to protect you because they want to steal your way of life. They want to steal your jobs. They want to bring their moral vices here. And again, I think that that's been happening over time. What is true, though, is that it's become more charged over time. And the context in which people are leaving because of global inequality, because of climate change, and because, you know, because of globalization, are so much more dire in many circumstances than what a lot of people were originally coming to the United States, you know, hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think that there might have been similar rhetoric. There might have been similar apprehensions about the people coming at all times. But I wonder, in the U.S., let's say, was the country just so fundamentally different 150 years ago in the sense that there were just these open swaths of territory and, you know, you hear of kind of these land grabs in the West, just a much different time where we can even think about these as parallel situations? Or is it kind of an apples and oranges type thing here?
I think that they are parallel situations. I mean, I think that there is that, you know, idea that, oh, there was just, and I've heard it within my own family, you know, well we're just, there was more room back then. And of course, right. There wasn't more room because that was all like pillaged territory that was, you know, right. Co-opted and et cetera. But and I don't mean et cetera as like sidelining it, but this was co-opted territory. And also the fact is that like the U.S. has a depopulation issue at the moment. And there are many towns throughout the United States, many towns in sort of like, for instance, former steel towns like Buffalo that actually need migration and needed new people to come to, you know, take up their housing stock and patronize the stores or open stores. So this, I actually don't think we're in such a different situation. I mean, what kind of territory that is open that we're talking about is perhaps different, but like our population is actually declining. Our birth rate is declining. And there are many places that are economically depressed and need people to live there and work there and buy things there. Buffalo is a really, really interesting case of like not a very lefty, you know, small city that really embraced immigration, and it's made a pretty marked difference on its economic development in the past decade or so.
If we then shift to think about the immigrant experience, almost psychologically, in terms of identity, in terms of change, in terms of arrival to new places, do you feel that, let's say, when you looked at your Greek ancestry versus what you see at the southern border, do you feel that the changes are kind of similar in terms of what they do to a person? And if so, like what are those things? Like how can you help us understand them?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I think it's difficult to say because I can't travel back in time. And I also think that the truth is that though my ancestors, when they came, were not considered white, it didn't take all that long for them to be included in that category, maybe a couple of decades. And also the way that they looked, you know, my grandparents, my grandmother would say, you know, she would go to the seaside and her mother, so my great-grandmother would caution her not to get tan, you know, to cover up, not to get tan. She was very aware that, like, dark skin in this country, you know, she was pretty new here, but understood pretty quickly, like, dark skin signifies worse treatment in this country, right? But it was easier for my family to pass until then they didn't even have to pass because they just were white, right? Because, of course, whiteness, like borders, is a figment of the imagination. So I think what we see today and the exclusions and brutalities that we see at the border and related to immigration today and this sort of strange notion that assimilation is the goal. I mean, I think the thing about assimilation is that it presupposes that there is such a thing as like United Statesian identity, that there is something to assimilate into when, in fact, any place is a constantly morphing, mixing dynamic and reality of social existence. So I think today when we hear about these pressures to assimilate, it's much, 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 much more racially charged, because the fact is the vast majority of people who are attempting to seek protection here are not white and cannot easily pass as white. And that creates a very, very, very useful and potent like political tool for, you know, mostly right-wing, but not only right-wing politicians to sort of say, look there, see that those scary dark-skinned people at your border? You know, they're sort of speaking to this white insiderness. Like, you need me and us to protect you against them. And that is what is deeply, deeply disturbing to me, is just how racially charged this all is.
Yeah, well, let's stay there for a second, because is it fair to think that even when your family was coming, say, from Greece, and there's questions around whiteness or not, that throughout the history of the U.S., including now, that the dominant powers would have been some form of a Protestant white upper class person that was in the seat of power for hundreds of years, and that we've had to kind of work within that framework to understand these questions? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, it's important to remember that, like, JFK, the problem with JFK was that he was Catholic,
you know? Right.
That's pretty wild to think about. And that wasn't all that long ago. I think that the locus of power has been sort of expanding in terms of like who gets to be included in that sort of, you know, acceptable ruling class. And yes, of course, we have very powerful politicians of color, not nearly enough, not representative enough of who we are as a country. But I do think that Protestant whiteness has been the dominant kind of insider standard for this country since its inception.
You know, if we keep this in the kind of political sphere for a second, and you know, I call upon your years of reporting on these stories for people that are, you know, here we are in an election year and thinking about how do I actually feel about this southern border that I have not been to. I don't know what it's like there. We know that there are stories. Like, what do you feel that you need to communicate to people to better understand the situation there and ways to think about it, you know, with a more perhaps open-minded place?
So this is a really great question, and it's related to why it was so useful and important to me to report from Greece, because it allowed me to check and investigate my assumptions about how things must be organized at our border or related to our border based on how they are. The first step is to really understand that the border is both a political and physical construction of our own making, and so we get to decide how it's run. And so a couple of things that are, you know, drums I will beat till the end of time and sort of happily and unhappily so. One of them is that we in this country treat migration as criminals. Ellis Island, where my great-grandparents were, and perhaps yours, that was the first immigration prison in the history of the world, exclusively immigration detention center. And the United States has made a massive business out of that. Because of this trend, this historic trend, we treat immigration here as a crime and we treat immigrants as criminals. We lock them up at great, great cost to U.S. taxpayers. I found in Greece myself thinking, when people were telling me in Greece, you know, like, oh, look, these refugee camps, they're like prisons. Like, look at them. They're like prisons. They're horrible and they can only leave sometimes. I found myself, even as someone who has like written extensively about the horrors of U.S. immigration detention, I found myself thinking, well, yeah, they're really bad. But, you know, in the U.S., like, we have actual prisons, so they really aren't that bad here, right? Which is to say, I was infected with this normalcy of, you cross a border, you go to jail. Like, that was something that I was infected with, even though I'd written, you know, I'd penned an op-ed that says the unnecessary cruelty of the U.S. immigration system. That was the title, you know? So I think that there is this way that we absorb, even if we don't realize it, the norms of the cruelties and barbarism and just unnecessary criminal nature of how we have set up immigration and the border.
Yeah, very powerful. And I don't know about you, but I think that this subject, let's say, of a border, when posed to people, you know, whether very, very liberal or conservatives, I think there's just a lot of question marks, even from a lot of people that are liberal. Like, because to me, my mind goes, well, what's the opposite of what we're doing? Oh, it's no border. Right? It's an open border. And then here I am thinking I'm educated or know anything. I think, oh my God, that sounds crazy too. Right? Like, so how do I work through that as to think about the fact that, okay, borders are a modern invention. It sounds to me like the American border is particularly cruel and kind of an economic instrument. But what does it mean to totally change the system at B that we've grown up, when all the stories we've grown up about, you know what, how do I answer that?
Yep. Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think it's also a problem of it relates to a problem of understanding about the border, which is that I have even been talking about it during this conversation, as if it's this monolithic system. There's a system. And in fact, all a system is a bunch of patched together rules and orders of operations and protocols. And so I think part of the problem is if we just think about the border, it's all very overwhelming. And it's like solving, and it's like, you know, I work in public education. It's like, solve public education. Right. You know, it's what? Like, we have to do, you know, we have to, like, yes, we have to, you know, attend to the massive inequities and problems in these large hulking systems. But the way we do that actually, and first and foremost, is through small, incremental, but powerful shifts. And so I think detention is one of them. Rethinking detention is, you know, as I said, one of them. But to this question of sort of like, what is the, is it like what we have now or open borders? I mean, frankly, there's a lot of really excellent scholarship on how open borders isn't just a, like, you press a button, the border's open, and then, you know, people come flooding through at their will and whim. Like, that's not actually, you know, I think that's like a misconception. That's not how it works. That, you know, that needn't be how it works. But I think that there's lots of smaller and really powerful things that we could reconsider at our border. For instance, you know, some kind of temporary permission for asylum seekers, putting more effort and energy toward the asylum system and toward our courts to allow these cases to not be in limbo forever. You know, it is a real, real Republican, it's wonderful for the right wing that there is such disorder at the border and in our courts. They don't want that to change, right? The right wing doesn't want that to change because that is useful to them. Disorder is a political instrument in this case. There's also so many possibilities of sort of worker visas and temporary visas that could allow people to come into this country for shorter periods of time to make money, fulfill critical, you know, fill critical industries that we have here, and have humane living and life experiences when they're here. And of course, the path to citizenship for the 11, you know, million undocumented people here, which is, again, this political instrument. These 11 million people are political instruments because the left can sort of say, these poor people, this is so unfair. And they can say that forever. And the right can say, we can't just provide a pathway to citizenship for everybody because that these people didn't get in line like our ancestors did. And we need a precedent for order. And in the meantime, we have an 11 million person workforce that is just doing the work that this country needs to survive, you know? So I think that thinking about the border as one monolithic problem is part of the problem.
Let me see if I can make sense of this with you. Outside of these questions also being political, do you feel that there's something here in kind of this yearning of human nature to, like, have a place and a feeling of permanency? Like, that's what I find so interesting, is that people move And then they quickly adapt to the place on whatever level they do, and they kind of claim it again and find a new tribe within an old tribe. Or I don't know. There's something to me that humans like this idea of being fixed in a place and in an identity, knowing, though, that we have all had to shift that a million times in our own lineages. Does that come up for you at all?
It totally does. There is this like yearning for a specific origin story homeland.
Yeah.
And that gets tricky because many of us do have that, you know, or a sense of that. But of course, no one place has ever been peopled by one people. And so there's this tension between this desire to belong and even this feeling of belonging and the reality in which every place is always in flux. And so I don't really kind of come down on an answer for that, but rather I kind of dwell in the complexity of it and enjoy the complexity of it and the questions that it brings up of like, what does it mean that my family is Greek or feels Greek? What does that mean when none of the living generation really speaks Greek and we haven't spent much time there and don't really have that many ancestors that we're in connection with back there, right? What does that mean to feel from a place and be distant from it? And that is, of course, something that becomes complicated over the generations of migration.
Do you think we all, in a sense, need to ask ourselves this question in the way that it's like, that why do I feel entitled to more power or rights as a white German American here than somebody trying to be here? Or what gives me ownership over this place that I live right now, right? Because it's something we all do. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And that's like just a beautiful encapsulation of sort of the key questions that my book is after, which is like, what does it mean to be from a place? And at what point in the story of long story of migration does one get to claim a place as theirs?
Is that even answerable?
I don't think so, because I think that belonging is actually a state of mind and also to some degree something kind of politically afforded to you through rights or through rhetoric. And so, you know, I think it's often a matter of time, but I think certain people, my ancestors, for instance, like had an easier go of that timeline. You know, that timeline was quicker for them.
Well, it's been so wonderful exploring these questions with Lauren Markham, journalist and author of A Map of Future Ruins on Borders and Belonging. Lauren, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now we'd love to hear from you on this subject. What questions do you have about immigration? What stories would you like to tell? Chime in on our Facebook group. You can find a link to that at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. And while you're there, check out our 4 years of archives. And don't forget that every Wednesday now, you can find the Midweek Reset, which is a distillation of one idea that comes up on a show. And a reminder that you can connect with me directly on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian. Also, next week, we'll continue with ideas of migration. We have a fascinating interview coming your way with Abram Lustgarten, who looks at reams of data and tells a story that perhaps the next great wave of migration may be climate-related and it's already underway. So we'll get to that next week. And we'll also continue our conversation today with someone who spent years at the southern border as a translator and writer. That story is coming up after this short break. This is Life Examined on KCRW. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard Lauren Markham share her views on immigration, borders, and belonging. For example, what does it mean to belong to a place? And at what point in time can we stake ownership over where we live? What gives someone that right? As Markham points out, immigration problems exist across the globe. They're regularly referred to as policy failings, political problems. And in the U.S., America's southern border has become a flashpoint. The reality, Markham says, is more complex. While studying at Harvard's Divinity School, Alejandra Oliva says showing up and trying to make the world a little better was a personal goal and an important part of her program. Oliva, whose parents are Mexican, worked as a translator, interpreter, and immigrants' right advocate in New York City, and wanting to do more, she traveled to Tijuana, Mexico, to work as a border volunteer. She chronicles both her thoughts and experiences in her latest book called Rivermouth, a chronicle of language, faith, and migration. Alejandra Oliva, welcome to Life Examined. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
There's this really fascinating moment in your life where you were working in the publishing industry and but certainly feeling some big questions or wondering what direction you were going to take your life in. And I don't know if that meant you already knew you were going to end up down at the border, but certainly there was something happening in you that I know would eventually result in going to divinity school. But can you talk to us about that moment in your life? Because it seems to set up a lot in terms of what would come after.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was just, I'd been working in publishing. It was something that I had sort of prepared for my entire undergraduate career. I'd done all the internships and everything. I was at that point doing some weekly volunteering with an organization in New York called the New Sanctuary Coalition, who put on a weekly clinic to help people apply for asylum. I had just started working with folks who were moving through the immigration system for the first time, and there was something about that, and there was something about the questions that are raised for me, and something about sort of what that work led me into that made me feel like there was more that I could or should be doing with my time, with my life, that there was a different calling. And it was a little bit both wanting to think more about religion and then also knowing that a divinity school was a place where people were going to be focused on questions about how to make the world a better place, how to be good people within the world, that both did and didn't focus on questions of policy and politics, but also focused on how we show up for each other in very real, incarnated ways. And I think that those were sort of the questions that I found myself wanting to chase down a little bit more and to follow, and Divinity School felt like the best place to do that.
Well, then can you talk about some of those really important first experiences of you know, from Divinity School, finding yourself down on the border, and how was it for you to begin interacting, interrelating, translating with people that, you know, were obviously in an incredibly complex situation?
Yeah, so I had already done a little bit of translation and interpretation for folks who were hoping to apply for asylum in New York. And that was as part of a weekly clinic where, you know, I would show up on Tuesdays after work, and so would they. And we'd sit there and we'd talk and we'd work through this incredibly complicated form for a couple hours, and then they'd go home and I'd go home, and I could, you know, forget about it for the rest of the week. I would go back to like sending tweets for my publisher, which was my full-time job, and it would just kind of be there in the back of my mind, but it wasn't something that was there every day, or it wasn't something that I could see as affecting any more of than the like 20 or 30 people that were showing up at the clinic. And like, you knew it was, but it wasn't something that I could fit in my head, really. And so then going to the border, I kind of thought that I would be doing more of that kind of like, here, let me help you fill out this form, let me help you like walk you through all this logistical paperwork that comes with literally any time you interact with a border. And instead what we were doing was accompaniment. And accompaniment is this practice, I'm not totally sure where it comes from, but I do know that it's a big part of like chaplaincy work, and it's a big part of sort of helping people move through spaces like the border, where if you're there with someone, there's not really anything you can do other than be there with them and watch what's happening to them and sort of receive their feelings about what's going on and talk to them about what this experience is like. And so you're there and you're doing all kinds of really, really mundane things. You are getting people coffee. You are sitting and talking to them. You're watching their kids while they like repack their bags for the 10th time to make sure that they are, you know, not carrying too much luggage or whatever. You're lending people your phone so they can text people back home or that are waiting for them on the other side of the border. And it's that day after day after day after day. And it's like everyone you see. There are certain parts, I was in Tijuana specifically, and there are certain parts of Tijuana that are just really concentrated in this idea of, you know, everyone who is standing in this plaza at this time is going to cross the border, thinking about crossing the border, employed in helping people cross the border, volunteering with people who are going to cross the border. And you get the sense of the scale of who's trying to cross, what they're trying to cross for. Everyone that you talk to has a very specific story about what has brought them to that point. Mm. Everyone who is there has a very specific idea of what is waiting for them on the other side, or a very non-specific idea. Sometimes it's just, I need to not be in this country anymore. I need to be in a different country because the people who are coming after me can't get me there.
Right.
And it just sort of blew open the doors in terms of seeing the actual scale of what had been going on this whole time without really knowing it or realizing it. And showing me the scale of, you know, what I had been encountering in a church basement in New York City once a week for 3 hours a week as just like the tiniest little tributary to what was a huge number of people who were all just trying to get through and get by and survive.
Right. Let's talk about, I think, some of the really deeper, complex philosophical questions here. And I'll start it with just a short sharing on my end. I remember when I was training to be a therapist, occasionally you would get a client in which there were so many problems coming from so many angles, from poverty to the food they were eating to racial problems to, I mean, I just goes on and on. And I was just felt like here I was as a young therapist, pretty much unable to do anything substantial for my client, mm-hmm. because the systems at play were so large and kind of dark and hard to be with, right? And then it began to raise questions about, am I even effective in what I'm doing? And if not, who am I doing this for them or for me? So I can feel good about the idea that I'm taking on a big system, and so I can feel good about myself at the end of the day. And I know that these are questions that you have been wrestling with, and you probably were down there as well. Can you reflect on that in your own life and in that kind of work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is something that kind of everyone who sets out idealistically to, you know, quote unquote, help other people runs into. You think that you're going to go down there and you're going to be a hero and you're going to be able to fix everything. You're going to be able to like make a big difference, yeah. and like do all these things. And part of that is these sort of narratives that we're given, especially as kids, of heroes of the movements, you know, the civil rights movements, gay rights movements, that it's always like these individual humans that are sort of pushing their way to the forefront and changing things and doing big good works. And the reality is that movements don't work that way. Sitting across from someone never works that way. There's never just one thing you can do that will like fix someone's life magically. Mm. And I mean, there are plenty of things that I can think of that would actually do that. Giving people work permits, giving people more money, things like that, that would make a huge difference in how someone's able to live their lives. But like often you as an individual are rarely able to be like, here is your work permit. Here is, you know, $100,000. Mm-hmm. Go, you know, get yourself a house and settle your family. Take the rest you need to do, whatever. I mean, I wish someone would do that for me, yeah. is sort right. of the society we live in. And so you're left with this feeling of like, okay, so I'm not helping as much as I thought I was. And I'm not changing anything. I always sort of liken it to that sort of parable that people tell about fishing things out of the river instead of figuring out where they come from. And it very often feels like you are just fishing people out of the river one by one without trying to figure out why they're in the river. And it feels exhausting and thankless. And there's always another person coming in and it just never ends. Mm. And you know, you make somebody's life materially a little bit better by fishing them out of the river, but very often you're not even actually fishing people out of the river. You're just sort of giving them a firm handshake on their way down and saying,
right.
good luck. And I still don't, I have been asked about this a lot. I've wrote a lot about my, like, wrestling with it in the book. Like, am I doing this for me? Am I actually doing something for someone else? Like, accompaniment particularly for me was very challenging as a sort of mode of activism, because I was like, I was very used to coming in and at least helping people fill out a form. And that form was, you know, the first step to applying asylum, possibly getting asylum. There were a lot of steps between that person and asylum, but I knew that concretely, you know, we'd filled out the form. This was a thing that could help. It was a first step. It was something. And when I didn't have that form, it was suddenly like, oh, I'm just supposed to spend time here. I'm just supposed to talk to people or spend, like, how does this actually help? How does this make their situation that they're going through any better? And that felt really difficult for me to sort of wrap my head around as a practice, until I think I kind of realized that the purpose of accompaniment and the purpose of sort of spending time with people, of getting them coffee, of watching their kids while they repack their bags, of listening to them as they wonder aloud, like, am I making the right choices, is not necessarily to concretely improve their life circumstances in any way, but it is to sit alongside them in the case or in these situations that are so high stress and so high pressure and can feel so, so lonely, particularly when it's you and the 100 people around you that are going through the same thing. Having someone who is not going through it but is still willing to sit with you, I think can be really, really powerful. And it has to be enough on an interpersonal level. But for me, it's never felt like enough. And so that's why I do things like write. That's why after Divinity School, I started working for an immigration nonprofit that did both individual legal representation of people who needed things like visas and asylum cases and work permits and family reunifications, but also did things like impact litigation and policy advocacy. And being able to combine those two sort of tracks of activism of, like, I'm going to sit with you, I'm going to spend time with you, I'm going to listen to your stories, I'm going to hear you talk about what your experiences have been and tell you that they matter, even though it can be really difficult to feel like they do when you are going about your day-to-day life, or when you are, you know, trying to explain this to a judge in court or whatever. But I'm also going to combine that with working on bigger changes. And I think both of those balance each other out in some ways, because I think if you're just working on the policy side of things, it can also sometimes feel like these problems are so entrenched, nobody's actually listening to me. Nothing that I'm doing right now is making a concrete change in anyone's life. Or, you know, I've been working for years and years and years on this one policy proposal, and it just got through, but it took me years and years and years, and it's going to make things marginally better, but it's not going to fix the system. And so having both be a part of my practice feels like I'm able to balance both of those things and feel like I can work on making an individual's life better while I also work on changing the system that that person is wrapped inside of.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I also want to talk about this. I feel like these amazing, interesting thresholds that you talk about in this book. I mean, translation being, you know, getting words from one side of something to the other, a border as having two sides, a river as being something to cross. It seems like that at the heart of the story is this really interesting metaphor about something we need to, you know, move over or through. Can you talk about that for a little bit and how you understand it playing out in this book?
Yeah, so I think that there are often two sides to something. There's one side of a border and another. There's one side of a river and another. There's one language and then another. But there's also all this in-between space very often. And I feel like so much of the book and so much of the work that I do kind of takes place in those in-between spaces. In a place like Tijuana, which is definitely in Mexico, but also full of people who are wanting to go to the U.S., who are sort of concentrated on this question of border crossing and are sort of held in this limbo while they wait to be able to do that. Places like the church basement in New York City, where I was helping people fill out applications that, you know, was definitely in the United States, but was also full of people, again, with these same questions of, am I going to be able to stay here? Am I going to be able to build a life here? What happened to me at home that means that I should be allowed to stay here? These kind of in-between spaces. And I think when we talk about things like language, it is this immigrant's language that sort of springs up in first, second generations and immigrants themselves of hybridity and of, in my world or in the languages that I speak, we call it Spanglish. Mm-hmm. And it's this sort of playground where you get to pull from both and have both and get to play around in both languages and use both and deploy them at the same time. And I think that there are times as a translator, and when I've done translation, when I've done interpretation, it's usually in these very formal settings where, like, you can't show up to immigration court and speak in Spanglish and kind of expect to be understood. You can't fill out your forms in Spanglish. But when you're really, like, talking to someone and when they're really, like, in the flow of telling their story, or they are using, you know, their whole semantic range to be able to describe exactly what this thing felt like, I think those are really joyful, incredible moments that show the promise and the beauty of these in-between spaces.
Well, how do you feel like this whole experience, one that it sounds like you still are very deeply a part of, has changed you or has made you think more about your identity as a Latino? Or like, where do you feel like you're coming out of in terms of being so deep in this story?
Yeah, I think that there have also been a lot of conversations about Latinidad and what it means in the last couple of years. Primarily here in the U.S., Latinidad as an identity that homogenizes and sort of papers over things. I feel like here in the U.S. particularly, when we think of Latino, we think of somebody that looks and talks and is a lot like me, which is to say Mexican-American specifically, you know, speaks Spanish, maybe first gen, not indigenous or black, and just sort of papers over all of these other identities that make up people in Latin America, in Spanish and other Spanish speaking countries. There's a tremendous community of Afro-Latinos. There's a tremendous community of indigenous people who do not consider themselves Latino, but still live in these countries and have really important cultures that have just been steadily taken away from them by the forces of colonization and that are often discounted. And nevertheless, there's this idea of Latinidad that kind of sticks with me. And part of it is that it's, you know, put on me all the time by living in the States, by being in these communities. But I think that where the promise or the power of Latinidad really lies for me is in this solidarity that I'm able to build through the language that my parents taught me when I was a kid, through the culture that I have from them.
Well, I'd love to end with a reading from the book. Do you have something that you could share with us?
Yeah, this is from fairly early on in the book where I am talking a little bit about what translation is and sort of how it's worked for me. Translation comes from the Latin, translatus, to carry across. The word itself implies an edge, a dividing line. To translate means to carry across languages, across borders, across cultures. Translation is something we do with our bodies, something that lives in our blood. We move through our mother tongue into new homes. We sense what the right word or phrase is, not with our minds necessarily, but with some kind of bodily intuition where shades of meaning dwell. Our bodies remember the specific flavor of words in two languages, the flavor of the edge between two ways of saying. As the word implies, we also use our bodies to carry meaning from one language to another. I've done all kinds of translation, the kind that involves sitting across from someone, knee to knee, and feeding their words back to them in a different language, translation of books, of essays, and articles for teenagers, of Know Your Rights pamphlets and legal documents, of someone's words well after they've spoken them. It's impossible not to feel what I am translating inside my body, impossible not to carry it with me from a church basement or a plaza or after I hang up the phone, damp and hot from being pressed next to my ear for an hour. In my translations for asylum seekers, this goes double. Their stories are often ones of violence against their bodies, stories that pass through me as they pass through language. I can catalog on my own body the places where people have shown me their scars as I've translated their stories, turning me into a mirror. Cigarette burns on the back of a carefully manicured hand. The aftermath of a surgery that was itself the aftermath of a stabbing. Someone's chest and the softness of their belly crisscrossed with ropes of scar and the punctured of stitches on either side. Old, old bullet scars running cleanly through both ankles. An onset broken leg, the weight on my shoulder of the man who used me as a crutch for a short walk. I don't know in my body what it's like to be hurt in these ways, but I carry a record with me anyways because it's impossible not to.
Just to reflect on that for one second, I guess what really hit me is the amount that you also have to hold as a translator, and that these are stories that, just as you say, pass through you as well. And, you know, how has that been for you to have to bear such close witness, you know, to hold those words and translate them? That to me seems like very, very, very difficult and serious work.
Yeah, I think that we are increasingly being given language around these questions of vicarious trauma or secondhand trauma, which is this idea that, you know, you don't need to have experienced the thing yourself. You just need to have talked to someone who has gone through it, or to talk to sometimes hundreds of people who have gone through it, and you carry it with you. You have no choice but to do so. You're involved in it somehow. And if I can help make the load a little lighter by sharing what that looks like and what that feels like for the people that it happened to, by helping to change minds, by saying, you know, this is the reality of what we're seeing on the ground, this is the reality of what people have been through when they show up here, then that feels like a very important part of the work also.
It's been such a pleasure to be joined by Alejandra Oliva, translator, interpreter, immigrant rights advocate, and the author of Rivermouth, A Chronicle of Language, Faith, and Migration. Thank you so much for the time.
Great. Thank you so, so much for having me. This was a wonderful conversation.
That's a wrap for this week. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. You can connect with the show on Facebook, or you can find me on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian. Thanks as always for joining us, and we'll see you again soon. Take care. Have a wonderful day.